This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Hawke's Bay, your community access media station. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.
Kia ora. Welcome to the latest episode of Peace Witness. Ko Liz Remeswal aho. I'm Liz Remeswal, and this morning we are speaking to Vijay Prashad, who is an Indian historian and journalist and activist. Welcome, Vijay.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Good to have you. Vijay is the author of 40 books, including Washington Bullets, Red Star Over the Third World, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and his latest book is The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power, which was written with Noam Chomsky. He is the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief correspondent for Globetrotter, and also the chief editor of Leftward Books in New Delhi, and a senior non-resident fellow at Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. So, Vijay, you've done a lot of extensive research over the years and a lot of activism, spanning topics from the history of the Global South to the fragility of the United States' power in the 21st century. So you've really had taken a close look at current global political challenges and the transformative role of what is going on in the world at the moment. So, growing up in India, and then when you were a young man, you went to university in Southern California, followed by a PhD in Chicago. So how was it was going from India to the United States at a fairly young age?
Well, it was not that complicated because I knew it was going to happen. My father had got in trouble with the government in India, and you know that was itself the indication that he was going to try to find a way out of India for a few years. And he sent my brother, and then he sent me. I mean, I had anticipated it happening. I was a young guy. You know, I'd started college in India. It didn't really go very well for me. I was not a great student. So I went off to California to work with my brother, who ran an auto parts store, a garage, and so on. And working with my brother, I got involved in the music scene. I got into being a disc jockey, you know, re-entered college, got very, very involved in two kinds of politics. One is solidarity with the struggles in Central America, partly because I had met some Salvadorian friends. And then secondly, on the anti-apartheid fight. And those really were, you know, those two struggles combined with being a disc jockey, I think, really made my world, because the disc jockey was the first experience I had as a journalist. People don't think of disc jockeys as journalists, but you forget that in the old days, we had enormous latitude of what we could do on the air. And I had the 12 o'clock to 6 a.m. radio show and played mostly left-wing punk rock music and so on. And between songs, I used to read out the columns of Alexander Coburn, used to make long, crazy commentaries. And truck drivers and others would call up and either argue with us, because this was the era of Reaganism, or they'd, you know, come and abuse, Governor Duke Majan in California. So really, I would say my journey into journalism started as a disc jockey.
Wow, that is just intriguing, and I never would have guessed that. Can you look at somebody who's, you know, had such success with publishing, and you're thinking, well, they must be really bright and really a huge swot. But that wasn't your start at all. It was much more kind of interesting, I suppose.
I don't know if it's interesting, Liz. I mean, what it is it's the story one has. Yeah. I mean, you know, education is a fascinating process because some people are very good at formal education institutions. Others struggle with the system. I was really not very good for, you know, personal reasons and other things at a lot of formal education, but I loved reading and I read all the time. I mean, I always carried a book around. I was good in sports. I was a young, when I was a teenager, I was a boxer. But while I used to lie under the blankets waiting for my fight, I was always reading something. I was the only boxer in our circuit that used to carry books around. So, you know, people have their own histories and strangenesses. Mm. I was very happy, and I've kept up with sports a lot. I write a column called Leg Glance about cricket. And I'm always very happy to encounter professional sports players who read and take an interest in world affairs. I'm intrigued by that, you know, why that's not more common. But in fact, you'll be surprised to know it's not so uncommon.
Mm, that's right. Well, of course, sport did play a big part in eradicating apartheid in South Africa, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I mean, sports plays an interesting role in all kinds of things. You know, it is, in one sense, a little bit of a democratizer. You know, you see the way in which it brings people together, but then you also see the impacts it has. I mean, I know lots of people hate cricket now. It's a fashionable thing to do, but hundreds of millions of people love it. In the 1970s, you know, people may remember that the West Indian team, you know, was a hugely political team. Vivian Richards used to wear an armband on his right hand, which was the colors of Rastafari, black liberation, black, green, and red. And they talked openly against racism and so on. Very political people, the West Indian team of that era. You know, and then, of course, you're exactly correct. The role that professional cricket played in trying to boycott players who went to play in South Africa, not allowing the South African team to play professionally, you know, and so on, regardless of the views of the players themselves. You know, even if a player took a position against apartheid, they were not permitted to play. It was a complete boycott. These things play a role, you know, in because we are not just trying to change politics. I think that's what I learned as a kid in a radio station. We're trying to change the culture. You know, people think, oh, it's a political thing. No, I think of myself also as somebody interested in transforming the culture, not just changing people's minds on this or that political issue. You know, like, for instance, our institute in February of next year is going to publish a text called The Joy of Reading in February. Why in February? Because in February, we are part of a international movement called Red Books Day. On 21st of February, in 2020, the first year we did this, just before the pandemic was announced, you know, we said, let's do Red Books Day. Let people go into public spaces and read the Communist Manifesto in their own language. Well, it took off. This year, in 2024, on Red Books Day, about 2 million people participated around the world. The epicenter was Kerala in India, where we think about 400,000 people participated in book fairs and other places. But in Cuba, the book fair was dedicated to Red Books Day on the 21st of February. I mean, we are hopeful that in 10 years, 10 million people will participate in Red Books Day. And I hope people in both Australia and Aotearoa will participate in Red Books Day, because this is about culture. You know, we want to promote the reading of any red books, books that are liberatory, that transform your imagination and so on. Again, it's not enough just to fight for political change. We have to win over the whole culture.
That's right. It's quite hopeful to think that reading is still retaining its popularity and importance with reading books, with the, you know, the influence of the internet, etc., too, isn't it?
I mean, I think we underestimate how much people read. You know, I once was talking to my daughter who was then about 16 years old, now 18, And, you know, I was saying, well, you know, your generation, people don't read. And she said, no, we do read. You know, for instance, she showed me her computer. She reads PDFs, different kinds of topics and subjects. And that intrigued me. You know, maybe we don't see people sitting and reading in a conventional way, but they're reading. They're reading different things. I mean, I'm a great proponent of saying, let's use social media to tell stories. You know, let's not condemn social media as a dumb thing. Is there a way to make social media a storytelling exercise? In fact, a few years ago, I was writing at great speed. I wrote this book in a matter of a few weeks. I was writing a book called Washington Bullets about coups and so on. And I decided on two challenges for myself. First, the book was going to by itself be rather slim, not a very long book. Secondly, each quote-unquote chapter was going to be slightly longer than a normal Facebook post. And so the reason I wanted to experiment with that is that, you know, if you're a young kid, a precarious worker, let's say in Auckland, and you're riding public transport, if you have a book that has a, you know, chapter 80 pages or 50 pages, and, you have to keep putting your bookmark in it every time you get off the bus, it's exhausting. You keep losing the train of thought. On the other hand, if the writer has written Facebook-length post chapters, you can read maybe chapters on the website, feel your confidence rise. This was something I learned from reading Eduardo Galeano, who was able in this very form to write very complicated narratives, but be cognizant of the fact that people read differently. And so I think it's not that people aren't reading. I think maybe we're not writing the correct books for the time.
That's a good point. Anyway, just coming back to you when you did actually go to university and obviously successful, was that a huge transition for you or did it come quite easily in the end?
I mean, it was a transition. Partly it was a transition because I wasn't, you know, like many young people, not sure what I was good at. I mean, I enrolled to study mathematics and ended up studying African history. And is a tribute to the kind of education system that was in the but, you know, again, if you go back and look at my mark sheet, they were not impressive. But I read a lot. I made a very good connection with a couple of professors. I would sit and discuss things with them. I was very much involved in all kinds of politics. I learned from my peers. I started reading seriously for the first time Marx. I was back in India as well. I got involved in the left movement. I was again reading the left-wing classics. I joined the Communist Party just when the Soviet Union collapsed. I was in graduate school studying, a population in India that is treated extremely poorly, a so-called untouchable population, Dalit population. The education came to me in a variety of ways, through political engagement, through having to do field work amongst a population that I didn't know at all, you know, even though we had perhaps lived in proximity. I hadn't known intimately their culture and world. And that was an enormous eye-opener for me. You know, I came from a relatively protected environment. Of course, I knew poverty. It was right there. My mother in particular never shielded me from the grip of poverty. But, you know, I didn't know it in that intimate way, the way people have to live it and so on. And that has marked me deeply because, I mean, you know, there are only a few ways for people to hate poverty. One is to grow up in it, and the other is to have a taste of its, you know, of its wretchedness. And I didn't grow up in poverty, but I had a little taste of its wretchedness and found the taste to be extremely bitter. And, you know, I knew personally that's something that I knew even then that this is going to shape me, you know, my thinking, my view of the world and so on. And indeed, I think it has. I mean, I feel that my hatred of the capitalist system, put it that way, is principally because it reproduces poverty generation over generation. And at the same time, tells people that if they just work hard, they can succeed, which is an absolute lie. I find that lesson I learned pretty early to be something that, you know, I can feel that lesson even now.
Do you think that modern journalism is doing a good job today or not?
It's hard to say, you know. Well, firstly, I mean, you're talking to me from a part of the world which, you know, might be responsible for the decline of modern journalism, since from hence comes Mr. Murdoch and, you know, and what he did. But let's not just put this on Murdoch.
I mean, he's Australian, this actually.
Yeah, but, you know, that sort of part of the world. But, I mean, the thing about this is it's not him. I mean, it's the structure. It could have been somebody else. It need not have been him. He's not so special. He's an accident. It could have been anybody else. But at the time, the monopolization of media was happening. And it is something that has just ruined the possibility of good journalism. I mean, you know, you can't get a story out there anymore. You know, I remember when I used to live in Beirut, I would pretty regularly, have a coffee with Robert Fisk, who wrote for The Independent. And, you know, Fisk used to regale me with stories of when he first became a journalist, you know, the Irish journalist working for the Irish Times, this, that, and the other. And at the time, I was writing stories for The Hindu, which is a major newspaper in India. But already he, you know, who was toward the end of his career, he died a few years after. And I already recognized then in the 2010s that, you know, our careers in the large newspapers was finished. Not by the internet. It was finished because the space for independent thinking inside money journalism is just not available. It's very difficult. Very difficult to get stories published. Very difficult to put viewpoints across. I had a longer tenure than others because I was writing about stories that weren't actually directly germane to Indian foreign policy or to the Indian system. I wasn't writing about riots in India or poverty in India. I was writing about the Iraq war, about the war in Syria and so on. So the editors found that interesting, and it increased the value of the paper that they had somebody writing exclusively for them from, you know, a war zone. But on the other hand, you know, I could see, like, you know, my colleagues in the papers from Europe and the United States in Beirut, I mean, they were basically writing press releases already. And I feel bad for our profession that so much of it has now become press release journalism, you know, stenography. People aren't writing, trying to put events into a historical context, to have a kind of pedagogy of the reporter, you know, the reporter as teacher, that the journalist sitting in a DJ booth in the 1980s, you know, saying, hey, this is what I think has happened. This is what I experienced. Taking a chance, taking a risk, you know, with your storytelling. None of that is permitted. I mean, you can't sketch outside lines. In fact, you know, the other day I watched that segment of a CNN reporter manufacturing a jailbreak in Syria. I mean, it's embarrassing that a channel like CNN has reporters that they built up who are willing to effectively do theater on the TV in the service of their paymasters, rather than tell stories that they have experienced with sincerity. So I think there has been a real decline. Now, on the other hand, lots of people have taken in a way to the internet to tell stories and so on. Very powerful. I mean, when there was the march, you know, against the revised interpretation of the treaty of 1840, you know, and all the images came out of Etora and came around the world through Instagram and other media. That was powerful. But even then, we didn't get enough context, discussion, debate, what was going on. I'm not very keen on what these phrases, alternative media, independent media. I don't like these phrases because it makes us seem like we are different from the media, as if they are the media and we are the alternative. No, I'm a journalist. I am the media. But the media without resources also means it's easier to put up images of a march than to take the time and effort and have the resources to, do a commentary on the march, explain it properly. That also requires training. And I see a lot of people online who say things sometimes without any of the protocols of our training. And that also, I think, is not great. There are skills. I don't believe in the phrase citizen journalist. I think citizens can have opinions and say things. But journalism is also an art. It requires a certain craft. It's not just anybody says anything.
That's right. I trained as a journalist in the 1980s, and in those days, a journalist's opinion was something to be avoided at all costs, and there were some journalists who didn't even vote because they took that that integrity and that having not conveying any opinions so seriously. But these days, there's a lot of opinion pieces by journalists, and I think it's affected the craft as well, perhaps. Do you think that COVID, the pandemic, has affected journalism at all?
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure because I think it depends on different places. I think wars have impacted journalism more than COVID. I think the genocidal attacks on the Palestinians has truly impacted and polarized journalism. There are now 200 Palestinian journalists have been killed. That's the first thing we should say. Several of them are colleagues that I worked with in 2014. Not several, two of them are colleagues I worked with in 2014. 200 journalists have been killed in Palestine already. That needs to be said. Secondly, the polarizing nature of the conflict in terms of the reporting. I mean, the very fact that there are main principal media, rich media, that continue to waste their time trying to debunk what they call the Hamas Ministry of Health, which is the Gaza Ministry of Health. They are contesting the death toll. The Gaza Ministry will say 46,000 dead. They'll say no, 20 of those names are disputed. I mean, for God's sake, that's an immoral form of politics, and an immoral form of journalism to spend that, time and effort. There's something called the Henry Jackson Society, which just released a report contesting the numbers coming out of Gaza, saying, no, it's much less. I mean, how much less is okay? How much less makes it appropriate to conduct this level of barrage and bombardment? So, I mean, I think that this has been very polarizing, this particular conflict. I think we've seen journalists with a lot of resources just fall on the job. We've also seen journalists resign because they just can't do it anymore. They just can't tell the lies any longer. And I find that also important to point out. They've asked to be transferred. They've quit. I hear from colleagues all the time from big outlets, rich, well-paid jobs, where people are like, I prefer to quit than to continue with this. I think this is going to have an impact. When the dust settles, if it ever will settle, I think there will be a reckoning for journalists who effectively endorse the genocide. They will face it one way or the other. I think this is different from, say, COVID, where unfortunately a debate still exists, whether, lockdowns were a good idea, masks are good. I mean, populations are polarized around the world. So I don't think there was a reckoning for reporters. I think with this war, where populations around the world are not so polarized, eventually there will be a reckoning. I think news media outlets with a lot of money from the West are going to find it much harder to be taken seriously in countries around the world.
Yeah, such interesting points you're making, and of course, what tremendous courage it would take to be a journalist in Gaza, really. Incredible. Look, Vijay, it's so wonderful to talk to you. I wish we had more time, but we've only got 25 minutes, and which is almost up. But it's always very interesting to hear your work, hear your commentaries, and of course that you're able to travel and speak to so many people around the world, as you have been recently in Australasia, Aotearoa in Australia. And I think you're back home in Santiago in Chile now, are you?
Yes, I'll spend hopefully a few weeks of rest before going back to different places. But I very much enjoyed coming to what I jokingly think of as Lesser Asia, and very much enjoyed it. And I got to see a cricket match at the MCG. That was one of the highlights for me, I'm sorry to say. I got to see Australia just pull off a victory in the first one-day game against Pakistan. It was great fun. Super enjoyed it.
Oh, well, that's wonderful that you managed to visit that very famous place and enjoy that match. I'm so pleased. Thank you so much, Vijay, and all the very best. Ngā mihi nui.
Thanks a lot.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Hawke's Bay, your community access media station. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.